Through the darkness of future past, the magician longs to see one chance out between two worlds. Fire, walk with me.
The past century of American history can be told through its crime movies. The greatest of these movies changed the trajectory of American storytelling, and they changed the way we as Americans see ourselves. In this podcast, we investigate these films and the long shadow they cast across the American imagination. This is The Long Shadow. I'm journalist and crime junkie Jonathan Baker, alongside my co-host and good friend, retired NYPD detective Jason Allison. Today, our inaugural episode. We certainly gave ourselves a challenge with this first outing. Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me was famously greeted with boos when it was shown at the Cannes Film Festival. New York Times film critic Vincent Canby said of the film, "It's not the worst movie ever made, it just seems to be." However, in the years since its release, the movie has been given a reappraisal. In 2017, The Guardian declared, a quarter of a century on, the film is being rightly rediscovered by fans and critics as Lynch's unsung masterwork. I've got to warn you, there will be spoilers about Fire Walk With Me, though we will be considering the movie as much as we can as a standalone film. And we won't be talking at all about the more recent season of Twin Peaks that appeared on Showtime. So if you haven't seen that.
No.
Despite Jason's.
Listen, there's going to be a whole special series coming on The Return.
Thank you. Despite Jason's anger and displeasure. Yeah. Here to discuss this controversial film is one of the most talented newcomers in the realm of literary crime. Chris Harding Thornton's Pickard County Atlas was called an atmospheric, slow-burning beauty of a book, rich with raw-edged lyricism and achingly real characters, by no less an authority than Tana French. We'll talk about Chris's book for a bit at the end of the show, but first let's jump into Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me in segment one, The World. We can't obviously talk about Fire Walk With Me without discussing the show on some level, and I think one of the reasons that Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me is actually a good film to do our first episode with is because Twin Peaks itself represented a massive sea change in American crime. Its influence cannot even slightly be underestimated. Like after there's almost like a before and after Twin Peaks in the way that American crime and really like in television in general. When Twin Peaks debuted on ABC in 1990, the other crime shows on TV were like Matlock, In the Heat of the Night, LA Law, just a completely different, this was like nothing anyone had ever seen. So I want to talk about that. Like what happened with Twin Peaks? Why did it sort of shake the world? And I remember watching it, you know, I think I was 15, but I watched the, you know, the first episode and I'm like, what the hell is this? I remember thinking this is on network television. It was crazy, you know? And since then, you know, things have really changed. So what was your experience, Chris?
So I was a couple years older, I think. And I was busy going out all the time and drinking and things. And so I missed the TV show, and I actually saw Fire Walk With Me first.
Wow.
And so to me, it is a standalone movie. And then I went back, of course, immediately and watched the series. And to me, the series was kind of... Well, I know that Frost and Lynch have talked about Mary Hartman as being a big influence, and I don't think that they expected, I mean, I know that they had filmed like a standalone pilot that they thought might be the only thing that ever came of the whole Twin Peaks thing. They didn't expect, I think, at all to go into that second season. So it was something that they didn't realize was going to become this sort of cultural phenomenon either. But I think that the world was just kind of ready for it. It was ready for something that wasn't a lot of the same.
Yeah. I wonder what it was in the air. Jason, what do you think?
The pilot, I know they had to do a version, a complete 2-hour theatrical or television cut for Europe. And so that pilot's out there. I think it's called... No, Northwest Pass. You have it. Okay, so yeah, you know. But yeah, I think from reading Lynch's second memoir, I think it's Room to Dream, he talks about Twin Peaks, and he basically says how his agent, that Mark Frost agent and his agent had been discussing for a while, trying to get them to do TV, and they weren't interested, but then they wrote something together, and that didn't get off the ground. One Saliva Bubble, I think it was called. And that didn't get off the ground, but then they sort of...
You're telling me that something called One Saliva Bubble didn't get off the ground?
That's yes. Not what it was called. I have it on VHS. No, there's the VHS is broken.
And we're already arguing. No, there was a project that they... It's in my Criterion. Where is it? Hang on. talk amongst yourselves.
I want to talk... Okay, while you find that, I want to talk about Mark Frost for a minute because I feel like he does not get the respect he deserves. Everyone talks about Lynch. Lynch is this giant of American, you know, he's an auteur, he's a visionary. But Mark Frost created Hill Street Blues, which before Twin Peaks, Hill Street Blues was, in my opinion, the most important American crime show, the most influential. Because before Hill Street Blues, every episode of a show would have these self-contained plots. But Hill Street Blues started carrying the plots forward, and you would like start to... It was almost like the soap opera model carried into a crime realm. And I love Hill Street Blues. I'm a huge Hill Street Blues. I still hear that that opening song, and my heart just drops into my stomach. It's such a perfect thing, and that... You know, in the car, in the snow, and like, oh, it's so good. So anyway, I just think that Frost really was the perfect partner for David Lynch, because David Lynch, of course, is like wandering the outre, like, you know, nether regions of the, you know, human psyche. And Frost was a good old fashioned storyteller, man. He knew how to plot. And that's why that first season, because they both left after the first season. And and then the whole thing went to shit.
It did.
For better or worse, the story of the Frost-Lynch partnership has always been Lynch brings the weird and Frost brings the structure.
Right.
And that the two of them together sort of are able to provide this different elevated kind of television entertainment that you would not get with any of them on their own. Because Lynch on his own, in Fire Walk With Me, can be obtuse. But Frost on his own can be a little more traditional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they both like at their worst, they fall at the far ends of both spectrums. You know, like right. Lynch, when Lynch fails, he fails spectacularly.
Yeah.
And when Frost when Frost fails, he fails in a very mundane sort of way. So some other influences, especially, you know, since we talked about Frost for a minute, who his influences clearly are more traditional police potboilers of the 60s and 70s, that sort of thing. And also, you know, traditional crime TV and noir. But Lynch also is definitely like firmly in the noir camp. He was clearly so influenced by not just noir, but by pulp crime and the hard-boiled writers of the 1930s and 40s. Like, that is, like, so laced into his DNA. Where do you see that? Because I see this noir pulp stuff happening in your novel, Chris, and so you must be able to pick up on those threads in his work.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Blue Velvet, really, that, I mean... It is noir, you know, but yeah. I think that I also have a similar, for better or worse, I think I have kind of a similar creative process. Like I know that he like started Blue Velvet with an image of an ear, the song Blue Velvet and Green Lawns. And like, those were like the things that he had to figure out how they all fit. Oh, yeah. Like someone finding an ear, like just randomly. Yeah. Like, I think I do that same thing that he talks about as like a Rosetta Stone, where it's your job then to figure out like why why there's this ear in this field. Or for me, it was, why would anyone steal dead people's clothing and burn them up in abandoned houses? Like, what on earth could propel that? So
yeah, that makes sense.
Was that the first that was the first idea for Pickard?
Yeah, which was paired with a, you know, hearing like a voice just sort of rattling in my head that ended up being the 11th chapter with Pam narrating. Those two things like just kind of merged. And
yeah,
I didn't figure out what the hell it was all about until I was in revision, really.
Getting back to Lynch, the other influences that I see are like these 1950s sitcoms. There's this like squeaky clean like vibe. And Lynch grew up in the Pacific Northwest. Was it Montana?
Part of
Missoula, Montana.
Yeah. So he had kind of an idyllic childhood. Like nothing, you would think with all the horrors in his films that terrible things must have happened to him. But actually it's the opposite. And I think that's why he's able to sort of exist so safely in this world. But I think also his childhood was so idyllic that there was something creepy about it.
Yeah, he had a fairly, from what I remember of his memoir, he had a fairly, a pretty decent childhood by all accounts. But then what happens is whenever anything unusual does happen, it becomes so outsized in his memory.
Yeah.
And he talks about an image that he's used in a number of scenes. He used it in Blue Velvet, and he also used it in Twin Peaks when Ronette Pulaski comes across the bridge. There was a time when he was young when him and a friend saw a naked woman just on the side of the road late at night, completely naked, bleeding, just sitting there on the side of the road. And he's talked about this in a number of places. And I think when you live, when you grow up in that sort of idyllic life, the times that that facade is punched through, those memories become so much more ingrained in your head. Like if you grow up in a place accustomed to violence, instances of violence are going to sort of meld into one another. But if you grow up in a place where violence isn't supposed to happen, when it does happen, you remember it.
That's so interesting. And I think that because there's a real Lynchian quality to Chris's books. And I grew up in the high plains of West Texas. I think Nebraska must be somewhat similar, you know, also a flatland kind of unpopulated area where, yeah, it's just like that. Like things really pop when there's nothing around them, you know, and there's also this sort of eeriness. And I think that there's this eeriness all across the West because things just feel so epic and big. And, you know, in the 1950s, when Lynch was growing up, he would have had television. He would have been seeing The Honeymooners or, you know, I Love Lucy or whatever. And this, these sort of beautified, perfected lives on the black and white television, and then noticing the similarities and differences in his own life. And it must have been sort of an eerie world.
Well, and I'm going to go back to Mary Hartman and just the profound weirdness of that show, where it's like it tries to like make light of things, but then it's also kind of confused and brings in these really dark threads that are undercurrents. You mentioned earlier on that, people reacted, they reacted really violently to Fire Walk With Me. I think that's part of why I love the film, is like there was this show on TV that was full of bizarre, funny, quirky weirdness, some of it completely unexplained, and you know, but above all, it was kind of lighthearted, and there was something wholesome about it. But at the center of it, you have the murder of this woman who was raped by her father for like 6 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're clearly moving into segment two here, the work. So, yeah, let's talk about the movie.
Cooper, meet the long-lost Philip Jeffries. You may have heard of him at the Academy.
Well, now, I'm not going to talk about Judy. In fact, we're not going to talk about Judy at all.
Like, this is a really tough movie to watch for me. And for a lot of people.
I've seen it like 30 times, probably. Yeah. It's one of my favorite. It's a staple.
Well, why did you, you know, when we got in touch with you and said, we really want to do an episode with you, and we asked what movie, and you said Fire Walk With Me. That was so. Why did you choose it? What is it about this movie that you love?
I love the idea of balancing. To me, it's like one of the most... Oh, God, there's so much. I mean, there's so much beauty in the cinematography. And I think it's a story of redemption, ultimately. But the horror and the violence are so... There's an inevitability from the moment it begins. And you know that it's over before it starts. But, like, getting there and, like, having these characters deal with that inevitability is just... It's... I don't know. It's just this suspended moment of... Which I guess is life, but whatever. I don't know. There was something that spoke to me. Like, I even when I saw it in a theater after I'd seen it like 25 times, I saw a 35 millimeter print, I think, of it in a theater, and I was just sobbing by the end.
Wow. Like,
I think it's just, it's gorgeous, but then it's also like, yeah, sometimes it's funny. I mean, but it's just got this pervasive, I don't know. I also think that there was this really childlike thing that Lynch was doing, or David, I think more Lynch in Fire Walk With Me, but you would know more about the credits on it than I would.
Frost wasn't involved.
Yeah, Frost. Yeah,
yeah. Okay. That makes sense. There's this really childlike sort of like, it's this yearning to create a mythology of like, why would these people do the things that they do? And grappling with like mortality and death, and to me it's a movie that's all about dissociative states. I think Cheryl Lee does an incredible job as Laura Palmer, and I think, I can't think of the actor's name, but who plays Leland, her father, they both do this incredible job of playing two characters.
Yeah, it's true.
They flip in and out. And to me, what is happening in the Red Room and in the Black Lodge and all of that is like, it's sort of saying like, these other like entities kind of take over a human form in order to like deal with all the trauma that's involved with living.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. And one thing I've always been troubled by, I think, was the Bob character and how it almost, to me originally when I saw this, it felt like a cheat. It was like he taking the onus off of Leland Palmer, like, oh, he was possessed, so he wasn't really this monster. But really, it can be seen as this kind of dissociative thing. But then it's Lynch, so you never know, because he loves these kind of twin things, you know, like where there are, you know, two sides to every sort of personality. It's very Jungian, this sort of shadow self, that sort of thing. So it's interesting what he was doing there.
Well, it's like Albert, Jose Ferrer's character, Miguel Ferrer. I forget which is the son and which is the father.
I can't remember either.
Okay, the younger Ferrer, his character Albert, at one point in the show says that maybe Bob is just the evil that men do. And I think for Lynch, most of his work, excluding Dune, has been, and The Straight Story, has been trying to figure out if evil is a part of us, or if it was always there, or if we sort of invited it in. And I'm trying so hard right now to not reference The Return episode 8, but you told me I can't.
You can't.
So I won't.
Well,
okay, I won't.
It's funny, but... because I feel like the Coen brothers also... that's the big, one of the big questions for them is the nature of evil, and Cormac McCarthy too, which is why, you know, I think the Coen brothers made, adapted a Cormac McCarthy novel, No Country for Old Men. But there was something in the water in the 90s about the nature of evil, and also something about Pulp Fiction too. There was the movie Pulp Fiction, which is, you know, a huge crime movie in the 1990s, maybe the most important. The Coen brothers are super influenced by Pulp Fiction, and then David Lynch, super influenced by 1930s, 40s, 50s Pulp Fiction. And I think Pulp Fiction is a really interesting way, and noir, a really interesting way to explore ideas of evil in human nature.
I feel like that's probably true. I mean, for me, I can only speak to my own, like, I guess my own experience of the 90s.
And the evil that you do.
And the evil that I do. I think that the notion of evil as it's usually presented is a cheat in itself. I think that it's a way of saying, like, okay, well, that, you know, some other force, some otherworldly force has mm-hmm. taken over something. And I think that at the end of Fire Walk With Me, I think it's addressed, even when Leland says, which is a horrifying moment, but when he says to his daughter, like, I thought you knew it was me the mm-hmm. entire time.
Yeah.
It throws a wrench in the entire, like, Bob thing. And it's sort of like, I don't know. I think that, yeah, it's this weird, it's sort of like torn between like creating a mythology and dealing with the fact that people do things organically that are really freaking horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. That is maybe the most unsettling and disturbing movie or moment in the movie when Leland says, I thought you knew it was me. It's terrible. Yeah.
The whole scene in the train car that went from when, maybe not even from, maybe going back even further when Laura and Renette are with Jacques and Leo in the cabin, but the whole scene definitely from the train car just gets so unsettling and mm-hmm. so disturbing. And again, like you guys said, Cheryl Lee was amazing in this, which mm-hmm. and she was cast only originally just to be a corpse, a dead girl.
Yeah.
Well,
and Lynch saw something in
it. This is a good point too. The movie really slides. It starts out in a really goofy kind of way with Chris Isaac as this FBI agent, and the FBI stuff in the early scenes feels more akin to the TV show, and then it really slides into a much, much darker place.
Lynch tips his hat right away. The opening scene of the movie is Leland. You don't see it, but it is a television getting smashed. Mm-hmm. And it's literally the metaphor of Lynch destroying the mm-hmm. your memory of the TV show.
Yeah. So that's a good like trigger for me to stir the pot a little. I don't love Fire Walk With Me. I don't hate it, but I haven't been on board with this reassessment. And I don't love it as much as Chris does. And for me, which I don't think anyone loves it as much as Chris does. But for me, it's because the thing I love about the TV show is Harry Truman, you know, the sheriff, and like Lucy, you know, in the sheriff's office, and that kind of, and Kyle MacLachlan. I mean, Agent Cooper, like, isn't in the movie very much. He was only filming for 5 days, and then he kind of disappears maybe a third of the way through the movie. I need those characters to kind of, like, I love the darkness that simmers under the surface of Twin Peaks, the town, and the show, and the movie. But I need those characters to kind of pull me out of it occasionally. And when we slide into those dark places, it just doesn't work as successfully for me as, you know, say Mulholland Drive or even Lost Highway,
which are my two least favorite
interesting
David Lynch movies. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. I wonder why that is.
Were they not dark enough for you?
No, I mean, I think Mulholland Drive is really dark. I didn't want to take the time to like sort through the threads to create the narrative that I was going to inflict on it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know. And I just didn't connect to it as much as I did. Like, I needed those little bits of straight story that he threads through Blue Velvet. And of course with, you know, Wild at Heart, he was working from source material there, but
mm-hmm.
I need those little lines that I can actually follow through to the end.
Mm. Yeah.
And they were just kind of loops in some of his other stuff, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah. They were like Mobius strip plots, but, yeah. You know, where it was like looping in on itself. It's certainly not for the, you can't casually watch Mulholland Drive in the way that you could Twin Peaks, the TV show, or even, you know, you can follow Fire Walk With Me. I think maybe it was Mark Frost's influence that I was missing or something, but I hadn't watched this since the 90s, and I sat down and watched it this weekend. It was more harrowing than I remembered it being because I was young and, you know, like, I think the world hadn't gotten to me as much. And there were some scenes to me that just went on too long.
Like what?
Late in the movie, especially like when Laura and Bobby are out in the woods, just these kind of scenes that don't feel necessarily integral to the plot, but they went on sometimes for 2, 3, 4, or 5 minutes longer than they needed to. That's just me, but I think that Lynch has always had, if he's had an issue, it's been with pacing sometimes.
I think that that's fair. I think that scene's important because of that thing about dissociative states and the fact that, like, she says, Bobby, you shot Mike. And he's like, I didn't shoot Mike. And he's like, is that Mike? And it feeds yeah. into the whole thing that he has going with, like, mm-hmm. who is who and
right.
identity. And, like, I think that most of the cast members of the TV show definitely agreed with your assessment that they were like, I don't want to go to this really dark place. Like, there's something that I'm going to hold really dear about, you know, Sheriff Truman and...
Yeah, I think that there was also that I love the mystery of the TV show, and not just that central mystery of Laura Palmer, though I did certainly love that, but I love the mystery in general of the realm. And when he just started explaining and solving things, that kind of took the air out of it a little bit for me.
Well, blame ABC for that. They demanded an answer to the mystery.
But I'm talking about the movie.
Oh, even in, well, I mean, but by then it was already done.
Yeah.
And by then, you know, they had revealed Bob in what, early season 2, I think.
Yeah.
And after that, Lynch lost interest and stepped away. But like, even in the movie, like Frost wanted, from what I've read, Frost wanted to sort of live in the world, like you're saying. And maybe that's why you
mm-hmm.
sort of lean into his sensibilities in terms of what he wanted to write about. But he wanted to go back to the world, and Lynch wanted to do what led Laura Palmer to end up in that river.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it was less about, and I suppose I let influence me a little too much too, is that it's less a whodunit than a what happens,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. And for me, I think part of this, Chris, is that I really cherished, I remember the moment I watched the first Twin Peaks episode, and I was in my dad's living room in his trailer house in Fritch, Texas. And I remember, you know, Laura's body there on the beach. And I remember that tickle in my belly thinking, oh my God, like they're going to have a whole show based on what happened to this girl. Like that's a crazy idea. Back then it was, no one had ever done that. We'll talk about that in the next segment, but I was like giddy with excitement, but not just that. It was the first time I'd heard the Angelo Badalamenti music, of course, and those credits and this like just spooky world. And then as you watched it, and there was the log lady, and there was the, you know, one-eyed Jax, and there was all this weird shit, and you're like, this is so fucking awesome, you know? Like my little 15-year-old self, I was like, you know, my little Cure t-shirt goth self, I was like, this is everything, you know? And so when I saw the movie, and it was a couple of years later when it came out, and I remember going to see it in the theater and being excited about it, but it didn't have that element that I felt when I first watched those episodes. So I'm not saying I don't like the movie. I'm saying I compare it to Mulholland Drive, which I absolutely love. Like I'm gobsmacked by that movie. I've seen it numerous times, and I'm always just like desperately in love with it. And Blue Velvet, I love, you know? And so I'm comparing it to other Lynch films, which is a pretty high standard for me. By that measure, it doesn't work as well as some of the others.
For most of my life, like for movies growing up and everything, I was drawn to realism. And I still have a memory, much like you do. My memory is in a bodega in the Bronx where a friend of mine and I used to stop to play Street Fighter before we'd go to school. And I remember after, it was one of the Red Room episodes. And he watched it, and I watched it. And we did not play a single game that morning. And we missed 2 buses.
Yeah.
And all we could think of was the man from another place, everyone talking backwards.
Yeah.
And for me, it was how Lynch was different from everything else on TV. And I get, you know, the log lady and sort of the warm aspects of the show that made it a more complete experience. But I don't know, man, the memories for me of the strangest parts of Twin Peaks mm-hmm. are what keep bringing me back.
Yeah.
Even to The Return, which we also, oh, I can't. Sorry.
No,
well,
it's inevitable.
Well, let's move sort of gently into segment three, and we can keep circling back to the movie. But segment three is The Long Shadow. Here's where we talk about how this movie has echoed down through American culture. We'll talk about its influence on TV, Twin Peaks' influence on TV, but also this movie's influence on just American crime storytelling, and why we still watch this movie years later.
I think you want to take me home now.
What you were talking about, Jason, I think is integral to everything, which is that, yeah, I was the same way. I remember talking to my friends about those Red Room episodes, or the first time the Giant showed up, I was like, what the hell is this? You know? And I remember talking to my friends and we were like, you know, like we were water cooler talking, like teenagers don't water cooler talk, like trying to unpack mysteries on television. But we were like, what is the Giant? What does he represent? You know, what is this Red Room? Who is this dwarf that talks backwards? All of this stuff was so far afield from anything that network television had ever aired that it was like a whole new world. It was so exciting to me.
Yeah, the same thing. And obviously we'll talk with Chris here about like it literally changed everything, because I don't think, you know, ABC, whoever it was at ABC, but someone took the chance on putting the show out there and they got tired of it real quick because the quality went down in season two. But then Lynch came back and they did the finale, the season two finale. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of opened up what television can be.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if you want to run that through line all the way down from Twin Peaks to The Sopranos, mm-hmm. and Mad Men and The mm-hmm. Wire and every prestige
Absolutely.
Show that's ever come, and essentially made television the preeminent medium.
That's what I was going to say. Twin Peaks was the birth of prestige television. Everything.
I think that that's true.
Yeah. Probably. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it felt more prestigious in its way, you know, like just even those credits and the music, it just felt, you think of something like L.A. Law, you know, or Matlock, and then you think of Twin Peaks, it's like, this is art, you know, and nothing against Matlock. I've watched my share of Matlock episodes and I like it.
I love Andy Griffith.
Yeah. But man, this
is two different things.
It's two different things. This is like art, you know? And I think there are three ways that Twin Peaks really changed television forever. The first is it was the birth of prestige television. The second way was that the sort of clues and mysteries that we talked about, the Red Room and the Giant and all of that kind of stuff, and the way that people started to search through the sort of like siftings and clues of the episodes to figure out what was going on underneath. We had never done that with a TV show before. You know, and that was the birth of, you know, The X-Files and Lost and so many other shows that we've seen since then. So all of those shows owe everything to Twin Peaks, too. And then the third way is the way that I mentioned this earlier, the way that Twin Peaks encapsulated a season with a single mystery, or really two seasons that were based around a single mystery. And we hadn't seen that before either. And now we see it all the time, you know, like Sharp Objects or Mayor of Easttown, or, you know, these shows, The Killing. Yeah. Where, again, like, I remember having my mind blown thinking, okay, so Laura Palmer is dead and season one, or see the first episode of season one, the pilot is over and it's a 2-hour pilot. And we're not anywhere near knowing who killed Laura Palmer. And that was the whole sort of like marketing around Twin Peaks was who killed Laura Palmer. And it was like so intriguing. You know, we kind of take it for granted these days, but man, it hadn't been seen before. What did you think about that? Do you remember that, Chris?
I think it's a double-edged sword. I think one long shadow that it produced probably was that, like that ability to carry on a mystery throughout as a, you know, in serial form, but I think it also shut down a lot of possibilities. I think it didn't do well enough mm-hmm. in maintaining the thread mm-hmm. that it kind of left people, okay, we're a lot more open to what's aesthetically possible on television, but let's not let people get too far off the script because then we lose them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it, you know, I think the only show that I can think of that really kind of tried to pull through that mystical sort of thing, and it backpedaled a little, and I'm not going to say that it was I'm not going to say it was successful at it, but the first season of True Detective, I think, brings in some of that, like, mysticism and, you know, what else is happening beyond what we know in the known realm of things. It waited a little bit long, and I don't think that's what made... I'm sorry, Nick Pizzolatto. I don't think that that's what made that television show especially successful, but I think it did engage people. It did, like, raise, it kind of elevated the conversation a little bit, where you have these people, like, with these long philosophical things that I don't think you would have seen before.
I think actually it came full circle with True Detective, right? Because Twin Peaks kind of got in trouble for not giving the story away, or it started, according to network executives, they had to come up with a resolution. But eventually the audience lost the thread, like you said. And my recollection of Twin Peaks in the moment was people being angry when they found out that there was no Yellow King, and it wasn't any sort of crazy, you know, a Lovecraftian monster, that it was a man. And I think that a lot of the Redditors sort of lost their minds at the fact that, oh, it's just another bad guy, when they wanted something more. And I wonder if that is a result of being conditioned by the Twin Peaks and the Lynches of the world.
It's definitely
sort of being
possible.
Open to a different...
Because there is a legacy of how Twin Peaks failed. Because it ultimately was a failure. It was a success in a lot of ways, but it was also a failure. Like, season two is not good, except, you know, when Lynch came back for that final episode. It just kind of, like, lost steam, because it didn't... Laura Palmer mystery was not enough to hold the whole scaffolding up. You know,
and you want to talk about things that went on too long, like that James, the whole James thing. Oh my God, I just wanted to kill him.
Yeah.
By the end of that second season, yeah. I was just like, I don't ever want to see him again.
Yeah.
But yeah. Which is not fair to him, because it was the writing. But, you know, if someone had conceived of the idea of a limited series in the era of Twin Peaks, it would have been probably perfection.
Perfect. I agree with you. I was thinking that.
That just wasn't a thing. And maybe, to a certain extent, that's something that it propelled people towards, was this idea of the limited series. I don't know.
There were mini series in the 80s, you know, but, like, I remember watching V and stuff like that, but it wasn't quite the same.
Oh my God.
The Thornbirds.
Yeah, there were so many. Yeah, and they were great, but it was kind of a different thing. You're right. And we didn't have these, like, long, you know, 10 or 12 episode things where it was an encompassed plot and narrative, and that would have saved Twin Peaks, I think. Like, that's what that show was needing.
Yeah. And then I think Fire Walk With Me was just a completely different animal, and it was just him exploring something completely different, which is why do we, you know, the duality of nature and things like that. I think that it's about much bigger things.
Yeah.
Baker said something else about, like, that this he sort of created or helped give birth to that Reddit sort of online sleuthing where everything means something. But at the same time, I think Fire Walk With Me actually subverts that, or at least sort of kind of shits on it, when Desmond and Sam Stanley are watching Lil the Dancer, and then she's making a sour face. It means something's rotten. And Desmond sort of explains everything in this very strange metaphorical character that shows up. And then Sam Stanley is a guy who's like, I noticed the thread on her dress was blue, and it was a different color. And he's like, yeah, fine. But what about the rose that was right on her shirt, right on the dress, the blue rose?
I can't tell you about that.
Yeah.
I can't tell you about that. It's basically like all the things that you think are important that you're digging into don't mean shit, because this character is going to get blown off the set. You're never going to see him again. And I'm letting you know right away that all of this stuff doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's this quote from Richard Bosch in, I think, one of the latest anthologies of American fiction or whatever, where he says that these aren't objects to be decoded. Right. But I think that's sort of like, to me, it feels like a moment. The blue rose feels like a moment where it's like, first off, there's that meta thing, because you get David Lynch. The blue rose thing is his thing.
They're right.
And it's a way of being like, I can't tell you about it, and all I'm going to show you is this really visceral experience from here on out.
Yeah. I want to just jump back real quick to what Jason was saying about True Detective, or maybe it was Chris. I kind of disagree that about True Detective, that people weren't watching as much for the mysticism. I was 100% on board because of the mystical aspects. And when I talk to people about True Detective, often it's because of Rust Cole's mysticism. And I don't even feel like when you find out it's just a man at the end of the season, I still felt like that mysticism was there. Like, even though you found out that this guy was responsible for this stuff, I still felt like Rust Cole was right in a larger sense. And I think that that has to do with Twin Peaks. I think that that kind of mysticism infused into a crime narrative was something we didn't see much before Twin Peaks. And we're starting to see more and more. Even 25 years later, and so much of that we owe to David Lynch, you know, I could kiss him for it.
When you look at what the world is, you know, in a lot of, I guess, the popular view, I guess, of what I see people talking about as far as the world goes, God, you want to hope there's something more.
Yeah, yeah. Just fun to believe, you know, that there's something behind the veil, you know. And when you, like, have the confluence of noir, you know, and mysticism, they're just such a perfect, like, marriage in some way.
And it's also when you don't have everything explained to you,
mm-hmm.
when you're not fed every clue or every aspect of the story, and it mm-hmm. requires a little more of an active viewing experience, and you have to sort of interpret things.
Yeah.
And not even, I'm saying, like, clues, just sort of like, just even, well, even with Lynch and even with Firewalk with me, just to know what's going on and where you are in the story and where you are in terms of, are you in Laura's dream, or is she in the Red Room, or why is Cooper there now, and is that an angel? It asks questions.
So,
right, and I think that's inherently literary, right?
Yeah, like, absolutely it is. Yeah, we all become English majors.
Right.
You know?
Thanks, Lynch.
Thanks, David. But I was going to say, every 10 years, I mean, English majors unite, you know. Don't you have a PhD, Chris?
I do, yeah.
So, yeah. So, you're on board.
I was desperate. I couldn't get a job.
Her stationery all says doctor.
Oh, man, that's so cool. Mine does, too, but I'm not a doctor.
Shut up. I don't have stationery.
I was going to say, cinema fans will know, cinephiles will know what I'm talking about, but every 10 years, there's the Sight and Sound 250 list, which they, this British film magazine called Sight and Sound, they poll basically all the critics in the world, all the film critics, and ask them their 10 favorite movies, and they aggregate it, and they come out with this list of the 250 canonical greatest movies of all time. On the most recent one, the number one film of all time, which bumped Citizen Kane off of the top of the list, was Vertigo. And I think this is what's really fascinating, is I think that Vertigo is number one on that list because of David Lynch and Twin Peaks and the influence of that kind of thinking, because Vertigo is the most Lynchian, like, movie of the 1950s, possibly. And it's because it's like, it's about this kind of like psychological mystery, and there's like, is there more going on than we're aware of? You can watch it over and over again, start to unpack it. So it's interesting that something can cast a long shadow even backwards, in a sense.
It 100% does. Yeah, always. I think that whatever we're thinking right now ends up definitely rewriting what we think about the past, for sure.
I can't wait to do an episode on Vertigo, so we can talk about all of this stuff.
I mean, people thinking that, you know, Firewalk with Me is great 25 years after the fact is, I think, proof of that.
Yeah.
The fact that it's changed in status.
For sure.
And people just hated it. And for a long time, I had the hot take. I was the one who was like, that's his best film. And everybody's like, shut up. Just shut up, you.
Well, Lynch,
I still stand by it.
Lynch's reputation has grown immensely in 25 years. Because you got to remember, like, Mulholland Drive was supposed to be a TV show. And a lot of those scenes were filmed as a TV show and then sort of turned into a movie. And I think that was on Showtime too. Jason knows more about Lynch, so he can correct me where I'm wrong here. But Lynch, or Showtime, was keeping him on a tighter leash in that, around that time, 2002, 2001, whenever it was. And you got to understand why, which is that his three works before that had been Lost Highway, which was not well received by critics, Fire Walk With Me, which had been booed at Cannes, and then, you know, and then season two of Twin Peaks, which wasn't really him, but Twin Peaks was like, you know, it was like rocky territory. So,
well, he couldn't even get funding, right?
Right.
Like,
everything's been funded through Europe ever since, right. I think, yeah, after Dune.
Right.
Everything else.
And there was also the Dune thing hanging over his head too. So,
right.
So it was really, I think Mulholland Drive is what really changed everything for him, because that movie, speaking of the Sight and Sound 250 list, I don't remember where Mulholland Drive is, but it's in the top 50 films of all time. It might be in the top 20. I can't remember. But then people really started to revisit. But I also think there's something about Lynch himself that really works with a 2021 mindset. You know, he meditates. He seems very sort of aware. He doesn't seem like threatening or creepy. Like, his movies are creepy, but he himself has this kind of like gentle grandfatherly kindness to him.
I think that Lynch has always been a person, or a director or writer, who has sort of sprinted out far ahead of the rest of us and then turned around and waited for us to get there.
Mm-hmm. That seems right.
And sort of like, this is where I'm at. You're going to be here one day. I'll just hang out here. And I mean, everything that I've read about him says that, you know, he doesn't really care what you think of him in an authentic mm-hmm. sense, not in the sort of flippant, irreverent, ironic sense. He genuinely just cares about the image in his head and getting it out to the world.
Well, and how he started, I mean, his whole thing was that he wanted to make paintings that moved. I mean, he's one of the most, I think, eccentric people. And if you watch his like early shorts, that's exactly what he's doing. And to me, that's another thing that Fire mm-hmm. Walk With Me is it's a moving painting. It's not, and it's supposed to be. I think the reason why it's my favorite of his works is because it has, I think, more emotional impact on me than any of his other films.
It like, certainly is emotionally impactful.
Yeah. I mean, it's horrifying. Mm-hmm. But then it's also, it has these moments of levity too. Mm-hmm. But they're all kind of overshadowed by what you know is happening and yeah. you know, the inevitability of it.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, this has been super fascinating to talk about. Chris, I wanted to ask you, like, how did Lynch, you know, affect your work, and especially Pickard County Atlas? You have another book you're working on, right, too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not going to talk about that one. Yeah.
We're not going to talk about Judy at all. I got it in.
That's great. I mean, I think overtly the most... I always try to do that same balance of like beauty and horror, I guess, mm-hmm. where it's, and I like the idea of like redemption. And to me, the characters are, you know, and I don't like it to be like tied up with a bow redemption, but to me, the characters all end up redeemed in what I've written. But, and also the humor, to me, this hasn't been big in the reviews, but I think I wrote a pretty funny book. I know that the end is not funny. I get that the end is not funny, but the end is traumatic. But you know, I don't know. And I tried to actually, I mean, I didn't try, but I think I just sort of intersperse weird things where I just want them to be like, there's a door in the back of like Harley Jensen's house, the cop in the book that I wrote. There's a door behind his house that's been there since he was a little kid, and it's a door to a cellar. And if you stand right in front of it, it looks like it just is a door into like he thinks of mm-hmm. it as like a portal. Almost.
Yeah.
If you see it from the side, you can see that it goes down into a root cellar, but it's just this door standing in woods, which is an image that I saw as a kid, right by where I grew up, part of the time that I grew up, because I grew up all over the place, but there was a door in the middle of these woods, and if you passed by it at most angles, it just looked like a door in the middle of the woods.
I love that. So like I love that, stuff like that. Yeah, that's very Lynchian, you know, for sure.
I find space for things like that that other people probably find tiresome, but...
Well, it's a great novel, and it's certainly not tiresome. And Jason, in fact, Jason said to me, or he may have said on Twitter, this is that your book was the best book, crime novel he'd read in the past year. And so I went out and bought it, and I just was knocked out by it. It's so good. So everybody go buy Pickard County Atlas. It's a slow burn in the best way. It's so atmospheric. It's so beautiful. It feels like a painting to me, too. And just a great book.
Thank you. I don't think of it as a crime novel, which is funny.
Everything
on the show has to be. Yeah, we have to think of everything as a crime.
Yeah, you're ruining this for us.
We have a theme. This is the first episode. Do not shit on this plan, please. It's a crime novel.
I just think that a lot of the crimes can be pleaded down to misdemeanors, but I think that, you know, there's
semantics.
You can edit that out.
No, it's great. Yeah. I think that a lot of crime novelists actually are that way, unless they're writing like police procedurals. But a lot of crime writers are just thinking about the world and about people and about character and about heavier stuff than writing a crime novel in scare quotes. Right. Anyway, last thing we're going to do is talk about something that we are into lately. It can be anything, a movie, book, show, musician.
You were warned. Don't give us that face. I warned you. I'll start. Okay. I have something. So another podcast turned me on to this. There's a show on Hulu right now called Reservation Dogs. It's by Taika Waititi, and I am terrible because I am going to forget the name of the other creator, but it's about four Native American kids growing up on a reservation in Oklahoma, and it is Lynchian, and it reminds me a lot of Atlanta as well, another FX show, but it is... I've only seen two episodes. I highly recommend it. It's about friendship, and it's about sort of people that we don't always... think about very much if you live on either of the coasts, but it's creative and it's inventive and it's funny as hell, and I highly recommend it. Reservation Dogs,
it's
on Hulu.
Really good.
Sterling Harjo is the other guy.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I am going to recommend something that will not be out till February and I have not read. So Sarah Gran, G-R-A-N, is a crime novelist who I fucking love. And she writes this series called Claire DeWitt, and they're everything I want detective novels to be, because they're like this Lynchian thing. There's mysticism, and they're sexy, and there's this weirdness, and they're so smart. So Sarah Gran has launched a new publishing company herself, and it's called Dreamland Books, and its first release is going to be her next novel, which will be called The Book of the Most Precious Substance, released in February. I don't have the sort of marketing copy in front of me right now, but I think she said something like it combines mystery and like eroticism and crime, and it's just everything I want. It's everything. I haven't even read it yet, and it's already like something I love. So I'm so excited. I just get excited whenever she comes out with a new book, but especially now that she, you know, she has her own publishing company and she can just do whatever she wants. And I can't wait to see what else this publishing company comes out with. So I'm excited about that.
Well, can I just say I've had like David Bowie's Is There Life on Mars? Like I've had that stuck in my head for like 6 months. And then I saw the trailer for Anderson's.
Licorice Pizza.
Yeah, Licorice Pizza, and it feels like I've tapped into some weird zeitgeist that I've had that song in my head for 6 months, and there it shows up in that. Yeah, so that's something that I'm into. Right now, honestly, I'm most of my time is consumed by reading really old newspapers.
For your book?
Yeah, that's most of my time.
That's pretty cool, though. Reading old newspapers is always fun.
And I just read the... the screenplay or the script, I don't know, whatever, for Chinatown, which I had never...
Interesting.
I had never read that before. So that was something just to look at, like, the beats and how that works. That's something that I recently revisited because I've never been a fan, honestly, of the movie.
Hmm.
But reading the script, I don't know. I think that, you know, you get writer's block sometimes, and the easiest thing to do is just read something, and then you're like, oh yeah, that's how it's done.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Like, you just do it. You don't psych yourself out about it. Like, just put the words on the paper and, you know.
Yeah.
To hell with what people think of it.
Thank you for name checking David Bowie, who makes a special appearance in Fire Walk With Me. I'm not sure what he was doing there, and we can discuss that on some other episode somehow. But thanks everybody for listening. The Long Shadow is produced by Jason and myself and edited by Jason. All the amazing mugshot artwork on our website was done by the incredible Jenny Robbins. Yeah, you can check out more of her amazing work at jennyrobbins.square.site. That's Jenny spelled G-I-N-N-Y. So it's G-I-N-N-Y robbins.square.site. Our theme music was performed by the incomparable Ryan Culwell. He's got a new album coming out soon, is my understanding. His first album, Flatlands, is the best album ever written about West Texas, and Rolling Stone compared it to Springsteen's Nebraska. Can't recommend Ryan Culwell's music enough either. So thanks for listening. We've got some great episodes coming up this season, including Taxi Driver and The Last Seduction. Some really great stuff. Double Indemnity. So keep listening, and until next time, keep to the shadows.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.